When ACT UP staged its first major public protest outside New York City's City Hall in 1987, Peter Staley was a deeply closeted Wall Street bond trader in his early 20s who had learned 2 years earlier that he'd been infected with the HIV virus. Seeing the protest inspired him to quit his job, join ACT UP, and become a full-time activist. He's one of the people featured prominently in How to Survive a Plague, a documentary about the rise of AIDS activism that was directed by award-winning journalist David France. The film, which receives a standing ovation when it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, opens in theaters in select cities this coming Friday. It'll be shown in New York City at the IFC Center. And I'm very pleased that it has brought Peter Staley and David France to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Good to be here.
David, I'd guess that people who go to see this film expect to see something sad or depressing, and they'll be surprised to find something quite different. Would it be accurate to describe it as a story of triumph?
Oh, well, absolutely, it's a story of triumph. It's the other half of the AIDS story, which was not just the story of tragedy, which we all know was dark in those years, but also the story of how the community came together, a story of self-empowerment, a story of activism kind of redefined for the new age.
And when Frank Bruni wrote about the film in March 17th article in the New York Times, he said seeing it gave him more hope and comfort than he'd expected. Mm. Did you get similar feedback from the people who saw it at Sundance?
Absolutely. The festival audiences that have seen the film so far get they find it kind of thrilling. I mean, and it is thrilling. There was just incredible revolutionary change that was taking place, driven by activists who knew nothing about science, trained themselves in the fundamentals of science, and really took on the entire scientific establishment and changed it so that it could respond to something that needed urgent response, like a viral plague, and modernized it really for. And that's really what we've inherited from them, this responsive.
The legacy of it is that other illnesses will be dealt with differently in the future.
Will be and have been. I mean, they created the idea that all aspects of research into a disease deserve to hold a place at the table for people who were struggling with that disease on a personal level. And those people now in all sorts of health struggles enjoy that access that was won for them by ACT UP.
Peter, I mentioned in my introduction that you were closeted when you came across that ACT UP protest. Do you remember what it was about it that convinced you that it was time for you to come out?
Well, I had found out in late 85 that I was HIV positive and had what I was diagnosed with, AIDS-related complex, as it was called back then. My immune system was already pretty suppressed, and I was given a diagnosis of about 2 years.
And then that was a kind of a death sentence to be found.
There
HIV
were no
positive
therapies in 85, and it was right after the Rock Hudson news broke. It was a very scary time. But I started looking around. I remained at my job and stayed closeted at work, but I reached out to my family, came out there, started looking around for others in New York that I could, you know, feel a part of and actually meet another person with HIV. Eventually stumbled into a GMHC support group and met a very active gentleman named Griffin Gold, who told me about the various politics that were going on.
Well, according to Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart, ACT UP to some degree was created because of frustration with the gay men's health crisis approach to dealing
absolutely
with this. There was fear that there would be a backlash against gays, and I'd imagine coming out during the 1980s, during the early years of the crisis when everybody was so frightened, was a very different thing than coming out today. Did you fear facing discrimination or even violence?
I did. It was very frightening. But once I joined ACT UP, there were hundreds of us, and they became my family, and it became a very comforting place, an empowering place through which I could come out. So it was about a year into ACT UP when my CD4 sales plummeted, that I decided to go on disability and devote myself fully to it. And I came out to work. I told them I was HIV positive. I went on disability. And within a week, I was arrested at their first anniversary demonstration. And a local TV news camera shoved a camera in my face. And
there was no going back.
No going
that.
Back. They labeled me as an AIDS victim on the nightly news. And the rest is history.
Well, at that time, as I remember, people were afraid to come into any contact with somebody
yes.
who was HIV positive. They didn't want to go into restaurant washrooms right. where they knew gay people might have been. I remember a woman telling me she was afraid to swim in a pool in her local YMCA. And in those early days, we had a debate on this show between a lawyer and a judge who allowed bailiffs to wear gloves when they brought HIV-positive prisoners mm-hmm. into court. The feeling was that, the lawyer said, that prejudiced the jury automatically. And it was really interesting because on the show the judge changed his mind and changed his ruling.
Interesting.
But
it was a time
was
of
real
incredible,
fear.
Profound fear. And it was very early. I mean, we only learned that it was a viral infection in 1983, 1984. Before that, there were myriad theories about how this might be transmitted. One of them was that it may even be airborne. So it took a while for us to settle onto a scientific understanding of what HIV was and how it was being transmitted, and even longer to develop a kind of a social and cultural response that acknowledged that and made it plain that you were not going to just by proximity, expose yourself.
Well, people are afraid to go to the dentist because mm-hmm. it was a story of some dentist whose
right.
drill had somehow
right a mysterious story.
Most of our early actions, the cops would wear yellow kitchen gloves,
latex gloves,
thick rubber gloves in order to arrest us.
And it wasn't just people outside of the health world; it was doctors. I was getting calls as a reporter back then for the gay community papers. I was getting calls from within hospitals from patients saying that they had been there for days. They hadn't seen a doctor. They hadn't seen a nurse. Food was being piled up outside their door because people were afraid, even in a hospital setting, to go into the room and to show some modicum of sympathy and empathy for these folks.
Isn't ACT UP an acronym? What does it stand for?
It stands for the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. I think we probably came up with the acronym first and then fit in some words to make it work. But it works.
The acronym is a lot more effective than the words that have been
exactly.
applied to it.
We wanted something to catch people's attention and maybe to instill a little fear in those we were trying to change. As David said, we were pushing the scientific community, but even more that, we were pushing a very homophobic political community, including two Republican presidents, starting with Reagan, who did nothing about AIDS, and then George Bush Sr. So,
and Larry Kramer's play, also Ed Koch comes
right.
in for a fair amount of criticism.
Absolutely.
And
also
in the film as well.
Yes.
The closeted Ed Koch.
Well, he denies that, and I don't know. You've included footage of what must have been some of ACT UP's earliest organizational mm-hmm. meetings.
Yeah.
We see members planning the first City Hall protest. Who made those, and how did you gain access to them?
Well, the entirety of How to Survive a Plague is built around this massive archive of video footage that was being shot right from the very inception of AIDS activism. What was plain was that the media was paying no attention. And when the activists began to organize, they felt it important to capture for the future generations, the reality of what it was they were doing. At the time, you could only see people with AIDS on television as patients, either in doctor's offices or hospital beds. And that was so much just a small corner of what people with AIDS were doing that activists pulled together, armed with these tools of brand new tools of prosumer video cameras, to show that that in fact what was happening was was powerful, was fierce was the word that they liked to use, and that it was that there was some beauty and life being generated and encouraged within the community.
Although not everybody was happy about these demonstrations. In fact, Ed Koch is seen in the film saying, well, I'm not saying that they're fascists, but they're using fascist techniques.
Right.
What kinds of techniques were you using, Peter?
You know, this was very standard traditional civil disobedience. We were protesting in the streets. We were laying down in the streets. and we were doing it in great numbers, and we were coming out in the process. I mean, America had not seen gay men this angry before, and probably the action that put us on the map was the one at the FDA in 1988, where hundreds of people with AIDS shut down the Food and Drug Administration for a day.
First time anyone ever protested.
Yeah,
there.
And it led the nightly news, and to see these people who many of whom had a death sentence standing up and saying, you know, we deserve to be heard, and our government should be taking care of us or showing some concern, was a very powerful statement, and we generated a great deal of public sympathy.
Do you think that that is one of the turning points? Because attitudes, not everybody in America has a different attitude about gays and lesbians, but attitudes have changed. The polls indicate
absolutely
that they've changed a lot since the 80s. Do you think that ACT UP played a role in that?
ACT UP was in the forefront. They were in the vanguard. And the demonstration that Peter talks about was the first time we saw people with AIDS patients on the television demanding health care. It was, as I pointed out, the first time anyone went to the Food and Drug Administration to stage a demonstration. And it really began – it was a message that Americans could understand. These people want pills. You know, they want drugs.
Well, there were no drugs, but we'll come back to that.
But there were drugs, and that was the point that they were making at the demonstration. There are drugs out there that show efficacy that are being used in other countries but aren't being used in this country. They're not even being tested in this country, and they're being kept from the people who want them.
We'll come back to AZT and the other drugs, right, and the creation of the cocktail and whatever else we can get to,
right,
after we take a little break. My guests are David France, whose latest film is How to Survive a Plague. It opens at the IFC Center here in New York this coming Friday. And Peter Staley, who is one of the ACT UP activists who is featured prominently in the film. Oh, this is actually your first film.
It is,
you've,
yeah,
been reporting on a long time. I just assumed,
been,
based on the fact that the film works so well,
you'd
done thousands of documentaries in the past.
This is my first outing.
We'll be back right after this. Great food is all around us here in New York, in restaurant shops and even in food trucks. But have you thought about some of the ingredients that grow wild as weeds all over the city? Join me in the Green Space on Tuesday, October 2nd, when I talk to Mads Refslund, one of the creators of the celebrated restaurant Noma, about how these forage foods are making their way onto plates at the world's best restaurants. Also, we'll be joined by a woman who supplies her garden's weeds to Daniel Ballou's restaurants. For tickets and more information about the entire Lopate and Locavore series, visit wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Tickets are going fast, but I hope to see you there. This is WNYC, wnyc.org, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from New York Live Arts, presenting Voices of Strength, dance and theater by women from Africa, a mini-festival featuring choreographers from Mali, South Africa, Ivory Coast, Mozambique, and Morocco, September 18th through 19th, 21st through 22nd. Tickets at newyorklivearts.com. The Metropolitan Museum of Art, presenting After Clang and the Wordless Music Orchestra, playing music from their new album, Pyramida, and guest conductor Matthew Corey, September 22nd, 7 p.m. in the Grace Rainey Rogers Auditorium. More at metmuseum.org/tickets. Asia Society, presenting Bound Unbound, Lin Tian Miao, the Chinese artist's first major U.S. exhibition, including several new installations and many works never before seen outside of China. More at asiasociety.org/NYC.
Think of how much you value the news, conversations, and cultural programs you hear on WNYC. Now consider passing that gift to a new generation. A legacy created through your will, qualified retirement plan, or life insurance policy keeps WNYC strong and growing. Call 646-829-4587 or email legacygiving@wnyc.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeffrey Toobin talks about how the Supreme Court decisions on Citizens United and the Affordable Care Act will affect legislation for years to come. His new book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Tune in today at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. We are back with David France, who has made a film called How to Survive a Plague. It opens this Friday at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village. Peter Staley, one of the people featured in the film, is also with us. And Peter, not all the people involved were HIV positive or even gay. And one of the people who emerges as a hero in this film is Iris Long. Mm-hmm. How did she come to be involved in it?
David probably can speak to this more as far as what mm-hmm. got her in the rooms.
Yeah.
But basically, it was just a moral issue for her. She couldn't stand by and watch while this was happening. And she showed up and had a very meek demeanor, was not a great public speaker, but she was an epidemiologist and knew her science, and we needed to learn the science, so she offered to start teaching us. And that's how the Treatment and Data Committee came about within ACT UP.
Which you joined as a member.
I joined pretty quickly.
Iris Long was one of those interesting historical characters who you can never really count on to appear out of nowhere, but she was. These figures are almost essential for how history changes. She had been working as a pharmaceutical chemist, and she knew nobody who was gay. She knew nobody with HIV. She was in semi-retirement, living in Queens. She was from Astoria, and she felt some sense of moral responsibility, as Peter said, to get out and talk to people about what she knew about the science, and to try and find a way to contribute. And she ultimately found her way to ACT UP after bouncing through offices at AMFAR and GMHC and found a home where she was not immediately embraced because she was such an outsider. But ultimately, people realized that if they were going to learn how to survive this epidemic, they would have to know what it was that Dr. Iris Long knew.
Now, why would a group like AMFAR, which was headed by a scientist, not have recognized her as somebody they could draw upon?
Well, that's not something I looked into particularly, but I do know that they put her, they gave her a job filing. She was a volunteer like any other, and they said, you know, we need to make sense of some of these medical files. So that was the work that she was doing on a volunteer basis. It wasn't enough for her, so she left there and went to GMHC, and they gave her a job answering the hotline where she was having to dole out, you know, just information about condom use and, you know, what we knew about safer sex, which, again, didn't feed into her expertise. So luckily, she found ACT UP in its first or second week and was able to help form the organization's thinking around science and their relationship to science right from the start.
And Peter, the film makes it seem...
To be fair, AMFAR was founded by an expert, Dr. Matilda Krim.
Mm-hmm.
So they had their act together from day one. But ACT UP was on a steep learning curve, and we knew we had to become expert as well in order to push the system.
And the film makes it seem like ACT UP members were able to get up to speed very quickly on the state of drug development for HIV/AIDS treatment and begin to make its own recommendations. How was that accomplished?
Well, we had...
Did you have a scientific bent that you didn't know about?
No, we had some members who studied a little bit of it in college. There were recent grads, but mostly it was self-taught. And we did these weekly teach-ins, Epidemiology 101 and Immunology 101, and we just started learning the science, and we became our own experts.
Wasn't there a split in the group at one point over tactics? What was that disagreement about?
It was It was late. It was 5 years into the group's life at that point, around 1992. And Treatment and Data was doing more and more. We were invited to the table more and more often, and doing more and more what's called the inside work of meeting with officials from the NIH and the pharmaceutical industry and the Food and Drug Administration, and continuing and ACT UP as a whole, the was doing the large demonstrations, so there was the outside tactic as well. And those started to butt heads. And so a lot of infighting started occurring in the last 2 years.
A feeling that the best approach would be just simply to work with the government and get real, get things done, where other people said, if we don't keep on protesting, nobody's going to pay attention anymore.
Well, the message that Iris Long imparted, the fundamental message, was that the organization, that AIDS activism, can't be trying to create a parallel system. And that had been some of the way of thinking at the time. Build these underground pharmacies, import drugs, run your own private underground drug trials. And Iris Long said, if we're going to get an answer, it's going to come out of these experts. We're going to need academia. We're going to need pharma. We're going to need government agencies to do the regulation. And so we want to make sure that they are working properly, not that we're ignoring them or trying to tear down.
Although some government officials were more open to this than others, the pharmaceutical companies seemed to be only move when they were seriously embarrassed.
Right. Well, that's this inside-outside approach that Peter's talking about, that it was a carrot and a stick. They could let people in and participate with them in these conversations, or they could face protests that would threaten their stock prices, that would embarrass them publicly, that would give them terrible headlines. And that was the choice they had, and they took the right choice.
Well,
the only one available to them.
The protests were focused on Burroughs Wellcome at the beginning because right. it was the manufacturer of AZT. And then unfortunately, scientific data later showed AZT alone was ineffective in prolonging the lives of people who were infected with HIV/AIDS. So when did the idea of a cocktail, the kind of thing that's currently being used, come to be developed? And is that didn't come out of ACT UP's work, did it?
Well, what came out of ACT UP's work was the possibility for rapid development of new drug classes. When the second drug class came out in the form of DDI, which was directly a result of the work that was designed by ACT UP for not to identify the drug, but how to get that drug tested, how to show that it was both safe and efficacious, how to get it out to the market quickly. Once that pill hit the market, it gave a hint to scientists that when you combine two pills, you have a better chance of not developing resistance than just one pill. And then after that, it just became a mathematics. And I think this was an idea that was hit upon kind of simultaneously in certain pharmaceutical companies, at the Aaron Diamond Institute where they were doing research, in various academic settings, that if you add the third pill and you add all three pills at once, then you had a chance of confounding the virus.
But part of the problem is also the way we do clinical testing on drugs. It takes years, and not just people who are HIV positive, but people who have various forms of cancer,
right.
who not sure they can live all that long. They're very frustrated by the fact that they have to go through these clinical trials. Right. In some cases, they're given placebos, so they don't even know whether they are the ones who might be helped by this new drug. To some degree, that has changed as a result of what ACT UP did, but not completely.
Directly as a result, really. What was discovered in the middle of this budding pandemic was that there was that science and pharmacological research was being done in a hermetic, academic, almost lethargic way. That it would take up to 10 and 12 years for a new drug to go from concept to medicine cabinet. But it didn't need to do that. And one of the first discoveries that Iris made in her work in ACT UP was that new drug trials were enrolling at a remarkably slow pace, and that was one of the problems, that they were trying to enroll patients with HIV in places like, you know, Alabama and Tennessee when the epidemic was raging in the cities. And one of the first innovations was to say, if you want to enroll a drug trial with people with AIDS, go to the people with AIDS and ask them to come into it. Don't go to the institutions you have these historic academic relationships with. And you can enroll these trials not in years but in weeks. And that really hurried along the process to the point where within just a few years, ACT UP, through these innovations, was able to shorten that period of time from up to a dozen years to 2 years and less for bringing a drug to market.
And Peter, you say that at the time that you joined ACT UP, you had been told that you had about 2 years to live. Obviously, you're still here. But the film does contain footage of some other people who unfortunately have not survived. Bob Rafsky, a public relations professional who was part of ACT UP from the start, often served as the group's spokesman. You got his family home movies.
Right.
He'd been married and had a child.
Right.
And we watch his health deteriorate throughout the film until he died in 1993, 3 years before the protease inhibitors that eventually curbed the epidemic were even discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Several people interviewed in the film described that time period surrounding Mr. Rafsky's death, the early 1990s, as the darkest time of the AIDS crisis. Is that the way you remember it, Peter?
Definitely. It was the early 90s and the mid-90s. 93 to 95, it just seemed to snowball. And ACT UP meetings were started every week with the announcement of the memorials that week or which of its members had died. And we had just learned in 93 that AZT wasn't the panacea we thought it was. So it was an emotional roller coaster. We had worked for 5 years. We had obtained this great power. We had caught the country's attention. We had changed the FDA. We had got the NIH working harder. And here, things weren't panning out, and the deaths were just snowballing. And we had to keep pushing forward. So it was very difficult.
Well, here we are in 2012. There are many people who still are upset about the fact that there are homosexuals in the world, describe it as a choice and one that people shouldn't make. That on the one hand. On the other hand, within the gay community, there are reports that people are not practicing safe sex, despite the fact that they've been told so many times that that could kill them. So are we far from the time when most of the important work was done? Have people forgotten the story that you tell in this film to some degree?
Well, I actually believe that people have forgotten the story in the film, or we've forgotten to transmit it to future generations. But I don't think that means that we haven't had great progress. The group of people that you talk about who are upset about the very existence of gay people have been reduced in number and in power over the years. It's hard to remember that at the beginning of the epidemic, and even by 1987 when How to Survive a Plague opens, gay people had no role in civic life. I mean, they were excluded from every aspect of civilization, really. We didn't have openly gay people in theater. We didn't have them in movies. We didn't have them in elected office, except for two or three people. As a journalist, I know we had very few openly gay people working even as journalists, and much less in science and other aspects. And that has changed dramatically.
Peter, is ACT UP still active?
It is. And in fact, it's going through a bit of a wonderful revival these days. It's joining the Occupy protest today. ACT UP San Francisco was recently revived. The AIDS crisis is far from over. There's a great deal of work to be done. And hopefully, to empower that future activism, we need to be reminded that we were able to create great change at one point. And this film will hopefully do that.
Well, David, you've been writing about AIDS since 1982. Mm. You're writing a book now.
I am.
Did this come out of the research you were doing for the book, or is the book coming out of the fact that you did this film?
Well, the book will cover some of the same territory, but the reason I wanted to do this film was because I really wanted to show that great things happened in AIDS.
And people can see it at the IFC Center at 323 6th Avenue at West 3rd Street. My great thanks to David France, who made the film, and Peter Staley, who is one of the people featured in the film. It's called How to Survive a Plague. On tomorrow's show, find out how the CIA used the guise of a science fiction movie to rescue six of the American hostages that were held in Iran in 1979. And then we'll take a look at the men and women who work in those unseen jobs that keep our country running, like coal miners and air traffic controllers. Filmmaker Rick Burns talks about how the massive death toll during the Civil War reshaped the United States. And Salman Rushdie talks about what happened in the years after the Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa in 1989 that called for his death. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egancy, executive producer. We had help today from Keith Karn, Galen Druk, and contributing producers Virginia Doris and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.